Hey everybody, welcome to South Beach Sessions. I produce this podcast. It's hosted by Dan Labatard. It's basically a long-form, free-flowing conversation between Dan and an interview subject. And this week's interview is with Sally Jenkins. She is a member of the Sports Writing Hall of Fame. This is not an easy industry to become a Hall of Famer in. It's doubly hard for a woman to ascend the way that Sally has. Many of you have read Sally's expose on the Washington football team and their pattern of sexual harassment. She has been very good for a very long time. She gets into what her career started like, what it's been, how it's evolving, her great reporting, and it's a really interesting conversation between two great journalists in their own right with Dan and Sally Jenkins. We hope you will enjoy this interview and reward us with a subscription to this feed. Here's Dan.
So a couple of weeks ago, I think our radio show was introducing you to the writing of Sally Jenkins from the Washington Post. I don't believe she'd ever been on the radio show before, but having her on reminded me of how not only I think of her as one of the very best ever at our craft in a family, right, where you can make the argument, I don't know which argument she'd make, that she's not even the best sports writer in her own family. So I'm not sure of that. Where do you side on that, Sally, before I get too far down the praise on this list?
Oh, Dad was the master. Dad was the absolute master. Nobody made it look easier than him.
Okay, I'm not sure I agree with her, but Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post has been doing it, writing columns, strong columns, for how long now, Sally?
Let's see. I started in 2000 as a columnist, so 20 years.
And what were you doing before that for the uninitiated?
I was a feature writer. I was doing magazine pieces for ESPN, and I worked at Sports Illustrated for several years. I had been a beat reporter at the Washington Post as a young woman in my 20s, covering college football and tennis and golf and college basketball. So I had hopscotched around a bit.
So across four decades, basically, right? Like your sports writing across four decades, and the earliest of those decades, really tough for women. Like, and then you were often the only woman in a locker room, I would imagine.
Yeah, so I got out of school in 1982, and I was actually already starting to work while I was in school for small local papers out in California. It was a big deal when I went into a locker room. It was there was a tension for sort of everybody.
Were you at the center? Excuse me for interrupting you, and I haven't even, sure. I'm not even done with her introduction. What I want the audience to know is this is one of the toughest sports writers that there has ever been, just because, and I don't know whether she's just going to shrug it off, but just because of how difficult being a woman in a locker room in the 80s and 90s could be, even as it, you know, you see this national reckoning around us in 2020 about the Me Too movement. She was in the most primitive place, right, Sally? I'm not misrepresenting anything when I say walking into a locker room during your time as a young woman early in the sports writing process, that you were, you know, around naked men misbehaving.
Yes, I would say that's true. That the Oakland A's, I can remember going into the Oakland A's clubhouse, and Billy Martin was managing them at the time, and it was, you know, it was brutal. He did not want women in the clubhouse, and he spent his whole press conference after the ball game. It was, you'd kind of cluster around his little desk in the manager's office, and I was the only woman in the room, and he never took his eyes off me. He absolutely burned a hole in my forehead. I mean, just glaring at me with, you know, utter hate and disdain, and it was, you know, it was tremendously uncomfortable, but you knew going in that there was going to be some of that, and that it was your job to ignore it and do the best job you could to talk to the guys who were willing to talk to you, and some of the ones who weren't willing to talk to you.
But how did you know it was going to be like that? I mean, your father comes from sports writing. The world has been a primitive one in terms of welcoming women in the locker room. Did you know because of him, or you just knew because it was being a woman at that time, a young woman at that time?
It was just being a young woman at that time. I mean, here I was 23 or 24 years old, and there were a lot of people in the business who didn't think that I knew the business. If they didn't know that my dad was Dan Jenkins of Sports Illustrated and that I'd grown up around it, you know, I looked like a little college twinkie who was shuffling around with a notepad, and they weren't sure I kind of knew my job, you know. And so your job was to be professional and ask smart questions and ask pointed questions and try to demonstrate that you knew what was going on, you know, that you knew what you were watching.
Why choose it?
Well, because my dad made it look like the most wonderful profession in the world, and it is. I mean, you know, I was no dummy. I watched my father work growing up, and I went, oh, wow, you know, if you're a Sports Illustrated writer, you go to Europe every year for the British Open, and you cover Olympic ski races, and you go all over the world. You travel the world, and you watch what my dad always felt was an incredible laboratory in human behavior. My dad asked a fascinating question. He said, who can explain the athletic heart? If you could explain the athletic heart, you could explain a lot about human nature. And so it seemed like an important profession, and more important, it seemed like a wonderful sort of adventurous profession.
And so you're watching all of this, and what do you wish he had told you? Or what doses of reality would you have liked to have seen because maybe you make a different choice for the parts of the job that were not as much fun?
Well, he should have told me that writing is breaking rocks with a shovel. My dad was a very facile writer. He was a quick writer. He made it look easy, and he made it look fun. And so when I started trying to do it, you know, I ran up against the reality that actually to write well requires 4 hours of sitting your butt in a chair and absolutely sweating and trying to put words together in some kind of coherent order that would tell the reader what happened and do it maybe a little artfully. You know, it was like trying to throw a piece of wadded up paper into a waste paper basket from an Indy car moving, you know, 200 miles an hour. You know, when I first started out, it seemed like an impossible task to write and write well on deadline. And my dad just said, learn your craft. You know, working for a newspaper is the best way to learn to write. You have to write every day. You have to write on deadline under pressured circumstances. And bit by bit, you'll get better at it. And learn your craft was what he said, you know.
He was a craftsman. He did, reading him, it wasn't easy. It couldn't have been easy, right? Reading him was so easy, but he had to have suffered it, or did you not talk about it, or why did he not share that with his daughter?
Well, he was a man of his generation. He was debonair, you know. Guys, he was a World War II generation. He was a World War II baby. And first of all, they didn't believe in complaining much or sort of bleeding at the typewriter, number one. It was almost an ethic. And number two, for whatever reason, my father was a great performer under pressure. He looked at it like an opportunity. A deadline was an opportunity to him, just like a great competitor. You know, the deadline on Sunday at a major when Jack Nicklaus has won the Masters at the age of 46, my dad viewed as an opportunity to perform and show off, which is what the great ones do. And that's one of the things I learned from watching him was you can't be intimidated by the moment. Here you are covering these people who rise up in these marvelous ways, and what are you going to do? Are you going to sit there and choke over it? You know, no, you're going to try to write up to their abilities.
Sally, you're just as good as he was.
Well, we're different. Look, writers are fingerprints. I mean, they really are. Every voice is different, and that's the first thing you have to learn as a young writer is that you can't be imitative. You can learn a lot by imitating good writing and studying good writing and what it is, but ultimately you have to find your own voice in the back of your own throat. And if you try to sound like someone else, you'll sound like a cheap little imitator. And I watched a lot of writers, good writers, try to imitate my dad and be less good than their talent really was because they were so busy trying to be funny or trying to be loose or trying to be witty like Dan Jenkins in print. And it came very natural to him. His voice was part Texas swing, which was the kind of music he grew up listening to, and part, you know, golf hustler on public golf courses like Goat Hills. It came very naturally to him writing that way. I was different. I was raised in New York City. I was a private school kid from New York City who ended up, you know, out in California. And so I had to find my own language and my own voice. And I was a woman. And one of the things I decided early on was I was going to be unapologetically female. You know, a lot of people back then treated women as inferior, you know, innately inferior. And I was like, well, it's not inferior. It's just different. You know, difference is not inferiority, right? Being left-handed is interesting. And I thought, why don't you treat being a woman in a man's business like being left-handed? It's not a deficit, it's a difference, and an interesting difference. So maximize that difference and make it as interesting as you possibly can.
What does unapologetically female mean to the uninitiated?
Well, I suppose it means, you know, we have sometimes different sensibilities about certain things. I mean, look, you're never going to get me in a conversation about the infield fly rule. You're never going to get me into a conversation about designated hitters. I don't care, and I will never care. And I think that's probably a bit of a female sensibility. Like, I'm not sort of caught up in the hangnails of the rules of sport. In some ways,
you like the soul, you like the societal elements, you like, Sally, I think the reason, I know your father was great, but the reason that I love your work so much is I believe that in print, and your father could have his edges, I believe in print you were tougher than he was.
I think that's true. I think in print I'm probably a little more judgmental in some ways about some issues. But, you know, I don't think I'm that tough. I just thought it's like Harry Truman, you know. Harry Truman was asked why he gives people hell, and he said, I don't, you know, it's like the old give them hell, Harry. And Truman said, I don't give them hell. I just tell the truth, and they think it's hell. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do, and that's how I see it, you know. If Dan Snyder's acting like a worm, I just say Dan Snyder's acting like a worm. And maybe because I'm a woman and I care less about the regard of NFL owners, you know, maybe that's part of the femaleness of being in this business. I don't care. I really don't care what Dan Snyder or any other NFL owner thinks of me. I really don't. Because their baseline probably originally when I first came around was they didn't care about me at all. Why start now? You know, why should I start caring about their opinion now? I'm not going to. So, I mean, maybe it's a little bit of an advantage sometimes, you know, not caring quite so much about certain aspects of this business or certain powers in this business. I could care less if Roger Goodell has me at his cocktail party at the Super Bowl. I really could care less.
Is that something that you feel like the sports writing genre is afflicted with, or the maleness of it?
Sometimes, sure. Everyone likes being an insider. It's no different from politics. You know, there's a lot of people who cover politics like being insiders. So lots of people who cover these leagues, you know, you acquire information, you know, by being closer to some of these owners or some of these commissioners. You are on the special call list. I mean, I've been on those lists a time or two with a couple of people, and you get invited to small select dinners and things like that. And you learn a lot from them, and you acquire a lot of information. We all develop our sources of information in this business, and that's just how that works. It's not denigrating anyone else, but I have the luxury of being a columnist, you know, and a national columnist, so that a beat writer can get very, very hurt by being ostracized by an owner or a general manager. It can really hurt their ability to do their job day in and day out. And so it's in their interest, it's part of the dynamic of the profession, that it's in their interest to sort of maintain good relationships there, or at least open lines of communication, you know.
Are you talking about like a literal boys club where you're excluded from a literal boys club because you would have been the only woman invited to some of these things, right?
No, and I don't think I'm excluded anymore. I think I would have been back in the 80s and the 90s, but I don't think I'm excluded anymore in any sort of formal way. I think I just sort of choose not to be part of it, you know, because I'm a columnist, not a beat writer. It's sort of better for me and my job to be a little bit of the outsider, you know? And because I started out as one, as a young sports writer, it comes a little more naturally and feels a little more comfortable, as opposed to being someone who has covered a team for 25 years and has a, you know, has the owner's home phone, right? Or cell phone, or the GM's cell phone, you know? Like, I just don't have that call list, and for better or worse, you know? I have some people I talk to. There are some NFL owners I have good relationships with that I talk to off the record here and there when I need to run something by them. The same is true of a couple of general managers. My friend Tony Kornheiser told me a long time ago, you're only as smart as the people you talk to. But I mostly don't quote them. I almost never quote the people I talk to. I let them inform my opinion, and it's always, for the most part, in my words on my page in the column. So I take full responsibility for whatever I write as my own opinion and don't lay it off on other people.
I want people to understand here and forgive the digressions, because I want to get into just how you became who you are going back before you were 20, just to growing up in a sports writer household. But when you're talking about the things that you're talking about right now, you're talking about some real old school journalism. You're talking about Washington Post journalism. You're talking about a journalism that's dying all around us now, as you see these reported details on Donald Trump and veterans, and people don't understand listening to this, the number of sources and how impeccable the journalism has to be when you're going to anonymous sources, and how unimpeachable the information is when it's being confirmed by the Washington Post, by Fox, by Associated Press. You are someone who's applying old school journalism sensibilities, and I can't imagine what it feels like to you in Washington to see what is happening in the country to journalism, and specifically that people don't understand how careful you have to be and how you put information in something as prestigious and credible as the Washington Post.
You know, I have two thoughts on that, Dan, and one is that journalists are patriots, okay? I mean, we really view ourselves as people exercising one of the most fundamental responsibilities that you can have. Now, it's not military service. It's not something worthy of reverence like that. But it is a form of patriotism to gather news that you believe other people need to know, whether it's for their safety or for their information. And we take it dead seriously. We really do. The best newspapers, the best newspaper editors are never afraid to admit an error, are constantly examining themselves and their consciences and their pages for evidence of, you know, hidden bias or on things that the biases that we might be unaware of. You know, so we take it pretty serious and we try to do a real good job at it. And then the second thing I would say about journalism is that it's, you know, it's a true love. It's not something that is going to make you a huge fortune and let you send your kid to Yale, right? It's long hours. You mostly work on weekends. It's a rather unrewarding job, and it's an industry right now that is suffering cuts akin to, you know, the car industry. Or, I mean, jobs are disappearing like crazy, and people are, you know, scrambling to try to find something to do to feed their families. So, you know, it's a job and an industry like any other American industry, and yet it's also got this special patina of being something protected by the U.S. Constitution, by an amendment, you know, to the Constitution. It's a fundamental part of our fabric as Americans. And so at the Washington Post, I just know how hard my colleagues work to get it right. I know how long they work and the hours that they work. And I know that as a journalist, you tend to be driving against the traffic of society, whether it's working on days that other people traditionally have off, or whether it's publishing things that people don't necessarily want to hear, but need to hear.
And given that sensibility, you've brought that to something as silly as the toy department, right? Like, because I know the serious journalists that work at the Washington Post. You're one of them. Your father wrote funny. Writing funny is really, really, really hard. I don't think of you as a funny writer. I don't think of myself as a funny writer, although you can be funny. You do what with all of that as my appraisal?
So, you know, my dad was more insightful than funny, hopefully, you know. I that's what I happen to think. He could be terribly, terribly funny and terribly sarcastic, but it was always with a point and with insight. He didn't just, like, throw a line out there, you know. And he wrote with a real ethic. Again, you know, like, one of the things he said other than learn your craft was he said, don't ever let a thing out of your hands until it's as good as you can make it. You know, that's like something a fine carpenter would say. You know, that's how seriously he took his work. He practiced it with a real integrity. And look, there's some bad journalists and some bad writers out there who don't have integrity. And then there's a bunch that really, really do and who very, very quietly go about their business without a lot of fanfare, just doing incredibly good work. I mean, guys like David Fahrenthold comes to mind, who's written like some real stunners for the Washington Post about business practices in the Trump Organization, you know, things like that. So, you know, look, it's the great pride of my life to work at the Washington Post. It really is. Not because of the reputation, but because of the people I get to work next to and because people like, you know, Marty Baron and Ben Bradley, you know, have tried so hard to get it right. And that's the environment I was raised in. I went to work there at 24 years old. And I feel like it made me as a person, you know, maybe more than a college education.
Okay, so I want to get into your backstory or your upbringing, but just one last question on this front. seeing Donald Trump in Washington take a hatchet to the news at every turn, and seeing people in America not discerning as much as they used to between the Washington Post and just something they saw on the internet, and the care that it requires to be the Washington Post versus just throwing things up on Breitbart, for example. What is the state of journalism as you view it right now, and what kind of heartbreak do you feel as you see it attacked with a hatchet?
Well, first and foremost, I feel like too many of us take the bait, the Trump bait. You know, he really baits the press, and the trick is not to swallow it. You know, the trick is not to get in a punching match with him. He wants to bait the press so the press will behave badly, so the public will take less seriously what the press prints in whether it's the Washington Post or the New York Times or NPR. And so, you kind of have to do like what you did with Billy Martin. You have to be above it. You really have to maintain your composure and your poise, and you have to remain very, very, very disinterested, you know, and just call them like you see them and not get personal, not feel defensive. And I think we've failed at that a good deal. You know, if I was king of the journalistic world right now, you know, we'd all be off Twitter. You know, I'm really not on Twitter. I think it's a toxic dump of a place where journalists do nothing but get themselves in trouble. A great example is the work should speak for itself, right? You shouldn't be going on Twitter kind of flogging your own story, right? And searching for clickbait. You should write a solid story or a solid column based on the facts as you know them, and let the public read it and digest it and draw their own conclusions. But these Twitter food fights are, I think, undignified, and they undermine people's confidence in us. And I'd like to see us get off, you know, and let the work speak for itself.
You were about to start down a path of a great example. Did you misplace the example? I'm curious if you had an example.
Bob Woodward. You don't see Bob Woodward on Twitter flogging his stories or his books. And you really don't see him. You don't see him interviewed very much either. You don't see him on Meet the Press. You don't see him. Bob Woodward lets his work speak for itself more than almost any great journalist in the business ever has. And I just think it's a tremendous example. And, you know, it impressed me as a very young journalist that he wasn't someone going on all the talkies on Sundays, and he's not someone as an older journalist going on Twitter. I just think it's the height of professionalism, and I can't tell you how much I admire it.
There's a big difference between whatever it is that's being created by journalism in that poison well that you're talking about and what you were doing in the 80s. Like, I don't know whether you felt like a pioneer or not. You were walking around in a locker room before the Lisa Olson incident, right? The Lisa
right.
Olson incident, I think, was in the late 80s or early 90s, where the New York locker room, I don't have my details right on this. I don't know if you can help me at all, but the New York locker room, or was it a Patriots locker room? I think it might have been the Patriots locker room. They were exposing themselves to her.
Yeah, Lisa Olson was in the Patriots locker room. The team was owned back then by a guy named Victor Kiam, who was sort of the Dan Snyder of his day. And it was a pretty unprofessional locker room. And, it was today we'd call it sexual harassment, if not borderline sexual assault. And not only was she subjected to that, but then, you know, those wonderful Boston fans proceeded to like jeer her and make her life a misery at any game she tried to cover in Boston. You know, she actually had to leave town over it. I mean, it's one of the great nasty episodes in NFL history, and it's just a real credit to Lisa that she weathered it and came back as one of our top female sports writers and sports columnists.
But Sally, how many years before that were you in a locker room enduring the Billy Martins? Billy Martins,
yeah.
Early 80s, late 70s.
Yeah, it was 1983 probably that Billy Martin was being so ugly. I can remember Fred Stanley. Remember Chicken Stanley?
Yes.
Does that name ring a bell?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember trying to talk to Chicken Stanley in the locker room, and someone behind him was going, and he had on his, like, I don't know, he had on a pair of little underpants or something like that, and some guy, one of the other ball players, is behind us going, show her your machine, Chicken, show her your machine, come on, Chicken, show her your machine, you know, it just was, you know, I was all of 22 years old. And he started turning absolutely scarlet. And I actually finally started laughing, which actually was probably the best reaction I could have had, because it broke the tension. And by the way, Fred Stanley couldn't have been, you know, more courteous. Let me tell you this. Most of the men, 99.9% of the men I've ever dealt with in locker rooms have been courteous. They really have. Much more courteous than, say, cameramen, who are also in locker rooms. And I never understood the objection to having me in a locker room when there was a camera crew. Like, I just never felt like a bigger invasion of anybody's privacy than a camera. I've always thought the issue was pretty laughable. You know, I make it a personal policy. I made it then and actually still make it a personal policy, actually not to talk to naked men. I think that's an inherently unnatural situation. It's awkward for everybody. It's not the best way to get a decent quote. Or a reflection on what happened on the field. And so I tend to wait for people to have a pair of pants on before I approach them and talk to them. That's not hard to do. It doesn't set you back any.
Sally, during the time that you were working at the very earliest stages, how many? You could probably count. You could probably tell me the number of women who were in sports writing then.
Yeah, Leslie Visser was a great, great mentor, friend, hero. Jackie McMullen and I are great, great friends because we got to know each other sitting outside of the grand jury room that was hearing evidence on the death of Len Biast. So people like Jackie, Julie Cart from the LA Times. I mean, I can name them because there was a handful of us, and we were good friends and saw each other in all the same press boxes and had a lot of laughs, actually. You know, look, it wasn't miserable. Don't get me wrong. It's a great business. And again, most of our male colleagues were incredibly supportive. You know, every raise or promotion or good assignment I've ever had came from a man in this business. You know, that's a fact. And it's true of all of us. You know, Christine Brennan was covering the Redskins when I was covering college football at the Washington Post. And our desks were right next to each other. And we were treated by Mike Wilbon and Tony Kornheiser and John Feinstein like we were brothers and sisters, you know. We had a great time. It's a great young staff. Mike Wilbon was one of my best friends. And I knew going into any assignment that if anybody gave me trouble, Mike Wilbon was going to put him through a wall. You know, I had a great experience as a young woman in this business, for the most part, to tell you the truth. The episodes where it was uncomfortable were few and far between.
I don't mean to misrepresent it. I just always marvel at the grace and the toughness of women during that time in our business, because among the cavemen in our industry, and I'm not talking about athletes or journalists, I'm talking about men, sometimes it's very hard to tell whether or not they love women or they hate them. And so I've found that women journalists just generally have it much tougher than I do. That if I make a mistake or I don't know something or in some way I'm embarrassed, I can get away with it without it impugning my credibility in a way where you guys have to protect every inch of space, because you were expected at one time to know the infield fly rule even as you were being unapologetically female.
Sure. I mean, you know, that's true. The standard was higher. You couldn't afford to make a mistake. It was, you know, the black quarterback syndrome, right? You know, you knew that you had to be sure of your facts. You couldn't afford to make a really big mistake. I mean, I can remember being at an Orioles batting practice one day, and Cal Ripken is running the bases, and he comes around, and I'm kind of standing, you know, there with a notepad, and I had chatted with him a little bit during batting practice, and he's running the laps around the bases, and he comes running by, and he just says to me, "Learning anything?" You know, and I just thought, what a jerk, you know. I mean, I know he's one of the great, nice guys in the game, but that was, like, kind of just a typical offhanded thing that told you what athletes thought of women sports writers.
But that's what I'm talking about, though, Sally. This is the stuff that I don't think can be underestimated. I don't mean to accentuate the negative. I'm just telling you that it had to be tougher than you're letting on, because Cal Ripken is viewed as a pillar of grace at the time. Cal Ripken was viewed as a superhero athlete, and that is sort of the attitude you're running in to on the high end of baseball star who represents everything good about, you know, sports masculinity.
Well, look, you know, the fact of the matter is that he was courteous and helpful. That's the most important thing, right? I got what I needed out of him that day. He didn't refuse to talk to me like some people did. But, you know, there were some guys who wouldn't talk to anybody. Eddie Murray wouldn't talk to any member of the press, much less me, you know. Again, what mattered was that you got what you needed, you know, to get to work. I mean, that's all I was really focused on. And the more you stayed on that track and focused on that, the better you did, to be honest. Look, you know, you were going to be a woman in a man's business. But I was a woman in a man's household. I grew up with two brothers and a dad who was a sports writer. So, I mean, it just didn't feel that bad, to be honest. And probably some of the little asides and insults I should have been more offended by. You know, maybe I should have taken more exception to Cal Ripken saying that. But I was young, and I did have a lot to learn, you know, also. So I just shrugged it off, you know, and went about my business.
How did it come to be that you were doing books with Lance Armstrong?
We got put together by agents and lawyers. You know, it was a business deal, really. That said, I really came to like him. I enjoy the hell out of Lance. I still do. And I've never judged him as harshly as other people do. You know, my problem with Lance Armstrong is not everybody else's problem. My only problem with him is I wish he had come to me when I asked him if he had something he needed to tell the world about doping, and he said no. And had he done what I wished he'd done, which was to say, okay, I have an issue and I need to try to explain to people why I made the decisions I made, I think he would have had a much different experience. You know, I think I could have helped him, and I think people would view him as Andy Pettit instead of the worst cheat on the face of the earth.
Wow, that's, you know, interesting. So hold on a second. So instead of go the route he did, which is do Oprah Winfrey and try to resuscitate his image in a kind of a ham-handed way, you're saying...
Way too far after, you know, by the time he did Oprah, like, you know, he was dead to rights in the USADA report. And, you know, what I told him was, I said, you know, people needed to hear this from you first, not from USADA, because he just looked like a liar and a cover-up artist. You know, he looked like he had intimidated people into silence. He looked like he, and maybe he did some of that. You know, he had been so combative about it for so long. And, you know, had he not played it that way, had he said, okay, you know, I've really got to own up to some things here, and had he done it early and been the first one to say it instead of the last one to say it, I think he would have had a very different experience.
No, and had you to craft it, right? If you were advising him, tell the story this way. That's interesting, because I would think that this runs against some of your journalistic principles, even as you're...
To be quite honest, I would not have, like, I would have passed him off to Amy Shipley at the Washington Post. I would not have done that journalistically. Journalistically, I would have said, here's my advice, you know, okay, here's my advice. My advice is you pick a good, credible reporter to sit down with and talk frankly and go on the record. That would have been my advice. And had he done that? You know, I think, again, people needed, had people heard this from Lance instead of some investigative report, they might have understood, I think they would have understood it much better. They would have been much more sympathetic.
That's multi-million-dollar advice that you were giving him that was declined, because basically you're saying he avoids all of that stuff, you know, the congressional stuff, that he avoids all of it if he had simply come out with the honesty early.
I don't know that he would have been avoided. I mean, I don't think USADA was going to not, you know, USADA is the Inspector Javert of, you know, of American sports. I don't think USADA was going to necessarily let him off easy in terms of investigations. I'm not sure that, you know, the Department of Justice wouldn't have come after him for, you know, to return a bunch of the money. I think those things might have still happened. But now he's sitting down as a cooperating witness, telling what he knows, explaining, you know, how a young cyclist gets drawn into this in the first place, who, you know, suggested it was a good idea to him in the first place. You know, that's what matters. How much did it really help him? What was he really taking? You know, we need a truth commission in sport, and Lance has become the biggest champion of this now, and I couldn't agree with him more. What we need is not more judgment and more adversarial investigations. We need truth commissions in which athletes feel comfortable sitting down and explaining what they are doing, why they feel they need to do it, what they regard as helpful substances that are merely recovery aids so they can climb an Alp on a bike another day, and what they view as legitimately performance enhancing that allowed them to cross a finish line ahead of someone in some unequal and unfair way. Because they have a much better idea than we do of all of this stuff, you know. They know. They know. We're guessing. Things float on and off the WADA banned list all the time because they don't really know. They're guessing. Caffeine, is it helpful or not? They guess. And some years they guess that it is helpful, and some years they guess that it's not. EPO, the science on EPO is actually very, very equivocal. EPO is helpful in some instances, but if you use it in the heat, it kills you. You know, it's not performance enhancing at all. And guess what? The Tour de France takes place in July. So, you know, there's just so many open questions about it. Then that's why I don't judge athletes. And this was even before Lance. Like, I never had the heart to judge Marion Jones. I just don't think she's the criminal of the century. All of this stuff, I think there are too many open questions, too many open moral questions, and I feel like someday we're going to turn around and that we criminalize behavior that we are later going to define as merely professional.
Wow, which is the greatest example of that? Like, which what are among them where you look and you're like, man, we judged the hell out of that when it was just a convenient morality for the time, and they probably should have been ahead of us medically in terms of healing.
Well, yeah, I mean, so, okay, if you've, you know, I don't care if you've ripped a tendon, you know, if you're a baseball pitcher and you've ripped a tendon, if you're just trying to knit yourself back together, why is that, quote, dirty? I mean, the language that we even apply to this stuff is so pejorative. Why is it dirty? Other people call it medicine, you know? In other settings, it's therapeutic. Athletes are the only people in the world where we actually try to govern their medications from this place of real judgment and, frankly, ignorance. If you're a roofer or a carpenter and you hurt your back, nobody's sitting around telling you, well, you're not a pure roofer, or you're not a, you know, you're cheating your profession if you do something to try to get back to work quicker. Why do we do it with athletes? Because of all the children's literature we've absorbed over the years. The whole ethos of amateurism, the intentional lie of amateurism that begins with the British aristocracy in the 1880s, or even earlier, Frank, 1870s, has so permeated, you know, our modern competition. And we really need to root it out because it's affecting our judgments on everything from college football to Olympic sports performance enhancement. How, you know, is it that a golfer can have voluntary laser surgery to improve his ability to read the greens, right? And we don't call that an unnatural performance enhancement. How is it that ball players are having Tommy John surgery to strengthen their arms, and we don't call that an unnatural performance enhancement? People are sleeping in hyperbaric chambers to build their red blood cells. How is all that natural, and retransfusing your own blood is unnatural? Like, what's the difference?
No, it's fascinating. I thought of that when the steroid calamity hit baseball, and I was just doing the arbitrary morality of, well, Kirk Gibson needed a kind of steroid. I understand it's a different steroid, but it's a cortisone meant to mute the body's screaming. The body is telling him, don't go up there and do this. Let me medically put this away. And that's okay. And that, and more than that, that's toughness. And then the guy who's using steroids because human growth hormone, because he wants to get a little stronger in the gym, is hitting 60 home runs because of it.
Yeah, I mean, so, like, we don't do a very good job of sorting through these issues and these substances and defining usage, right? What's therapeutic usage and what's performance enhancement? To me, you know, any athlete who's trying to prolong his career by using HGH in a medically supervised way to preserve lean muscle mass, which you lose as you age. I don't have a big problem with that, quite honestly. I don't have a big problem with guys in the NFL who are trying to preserve some lean muscle mass to extend the ephemerally short career of, say, an NFL running back. Like, I don't know why that is forbidden and why we judge it so. I really don't. Actors do it. I mean, God, Sly Stallone does it. Why is it so wrong for an NFL player? Hollywood does it.
When Sylvester Stallone is dumping testosterone off a hotel balcony in Australia, it's funny versus what we're doing with athletes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm an outlier here, but I would like to see us think this stuff through. I think we could really start over with a code and the way we deal with it rather than, you know, putting these people through these international courts. You know, WADA is a really bankrupt organization, and it's essentially, these things to me are rackets for siphoning off federal funds to support needless bureaucracies that aren't really doing much of anything. They're not deterring anybody. They're not really, you know, enforcing any kind of competitive justice that I can see. And I think we need to just start from scratch and start by getting a bunch of athletes and medical ethicists in a room. You know, here's the deal. Dan, elite sports, world-class elite sport, is not an inherently healthful exercise. It's inherently unhealthful. These people are driving their bodies to the brink for the sake of human experimentation. They're the astronauts of human performance and human capacity. So let's start by understanding that and then ask, what do they need? What is hurting them further as opposed to actually helping them?
Sally, you nailed the dismount. We're far away from your childhood and how you became who you became, but I appreciate the time. Hopefully we'll talk to you again and we'll cover some more interesting things because I found all of that fascinating. Thank you for being on with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thanks to Sally Jenkins for joining us here on South Beach Sessions. A friendly reminder to please, if you're enjoying what you're listening to, go back into our archive at South Beach Sessions. There have been many tremendous interviews here on South Beach Sessions. This was just the latest installment. Subscribe to this feed and the Levitard and Friends Network feed. I know what you're thinking. Mike, if I subscribe to Levitard and Friends, then I don't need to subscribe to South Beach Sessions. Hooey. I want all the subscriptions. I want to game the system. This is very transparent from me. You should appreciate the honesty. Subscribe to both feeds so I get credit for it, please. And if you've gone a couple of weeks and maybe, hey, oh, I'll just listen to the Sally Jenkins, go ahead and try downloading again, because if you're on Apple Podcasts, sometimes it'll automatically unsubscribe if you haven't listened in a couple of weeks. Do that with all our properties. Boost our standing in the podcast game. Even if it's felonious. That's what I'm begging of you. Also, while I'm begging, I might as well beg you to buy some stuff. LevitardAF.shop. It is the merchandise shop. It's been around for a while. We didn't necessarily feel comfortable asking you to pay money for stuff during the pandemic, but things are opening a little bit. Maybe some people are getting back on their feet. And also, we got some new stuff coming to that shop very, very soon. So keep an eye on LevitardAF.shop. It's the only official Dan Levitard Show merchandise place. It even says it on the shirt. You can support many of the characters in the Levitard and Friends universe. There's a lot of great Cody specific shirts out there. If you're a fan of the show Killer, you can wear your support. Go ahead and do that. I am done begging. We will be back on South Beach Sessions very soon.